Just a heads up, in this podcast, there's a weird noise that I couldn't figure out how the hell to get out of there. It's like a gremlin. So anyway, sorry about that. Welcome back to Avery Adventures Podcast. This week we have Robbie Denning back on again. I got a DM a while back asking why in our short podcasting history we've had Robbie on. This will be the third time. At the time, it was the second time. Aside from being my business partner on Rockslide, Robbie's one of the best mule deer hunters in the world, period. On earth, the best. I would put him against anybody on killing big deer year in and year out. And if you don't want to know or learn or listen to what Robbie has to say, I'll say it as nice as I can, but you're an idiot. You probably don't deserve to kill big deer. So anyways, we'll get past that. Robbie's on the show today, dropping more mule deer knowledge. I also want to tell everybody we're still giving away a Kefaru 14er, probably in 3 episodes from now. So this is number 22. So on podcast number 25, we're going to give away that Kefaru 14er, thanks to Aaron and the guys at Kefaru. You can always get 20% off using the code FATKID at mountainops.com. We'd really appreciate that. So anyways, here's Robbie.
All right. Welcome back to Avery Ventures Podcast. We have the one and only Robbie Denning back for a third time. I keep hearing that he knows some mule deer knowledge, and people keep bringing it back up to get him on here. Me and Tanya both know he's not the most attractive guy, but damn, he knows a lot about mule deer. Robbie,
I know I can see myself in the video right there. It's pretty bad. Look how long my nose is when I tip my head down. Holy smoly.
Dude, tell us a little about those 2 bucks behind you real quick.
Oh, dude, that one right there, that's the Broken Heart buck. He's in my book. I think the last buck story in the book. 6-inch bases, 20-inch G2s, one of the best bucks I've ever taken. He was my last buck with an archery equipment. Hunted him for a couple of years. He's kind of one of the bucks where I made up my mind that before the migration starts, these bucks stay put. I spent 40 days trying to find him. I think he was there the whole time. Only saw him a couple times, but... And then that other one, that's the one you did on the t-shirt. That's that 200-inch Colorado buck.
Nice. The Broken Heart buck was probably related somehow to the buck that I shot with you.
Absolutely, dude. I'm glad you bring that up. Look at his frame, and then look at your frame. They're big 3 points. You know, they'll have little G4s, not much. And, you know, not super wide bucks, but, you know, pretty tall in the back. That genetic seems to be up there. I've seen 2 or 3 bucks over the years like that.
Yeah. So how do you come up with the names that you name them? I've always been curious about that.
Well, you're going to have to read my book then.
Yeah. Robbie, I can't read. I've been telling you that.
It's in the story why it's the Broken Heart buck.
No, I just mean in general.
But he actually didn't get his name till after he died. But he pretty much broke my heart for 2 years. Chasing him. I think it's the longest as far as the number of days that I ever hunted a deer. I hunted him 2 years, well over 40 days. And, it didn't end well. I ended up wounding him and losing him. You know, did the best I could, but that's what happened. And, but that's where the name come from. And, it's a sweet deal now looking back. Everything worked out like it should, but, that's where it came from.
Those are both great deer. To start it off, we have a few questions from Rockslide Tanya's going to ask.
Okay, so like I was just saying, how do you decide what the deer's name is? Does it come from, like, do you plan it ahead of time or plan it, like, after you kill it? Because Jalapeno is the one that I was first introduced to. I'm hearing about when, you know, Rockslide, when I first started paying attention, I guess I should admit to. But when did you stop actually trying to find Jalapeno? What clicked in your head, or when did you definitively decide to actively quit looking for him?
Gotcha. Well, the first part of the question is, I don't name all the deer I chase. Sometimes you just don't have an opportunity to, like that buck I got last year. You see them, you kill them within a couple of days. But any buck I've ever chased for, you know, multiple days, multiple weeks, multiple seasons, they always end up with a name. Part of it is, it's just easier to remember who they are rather than, hey, that big buck I saw over there on that purple knob. So Jalapeno was a buck I first found in 2012. And he was a 4-year-old then. approximately, and ended up chasing him the 2012, 2013, 2014 season. And he just ended up with that name because it was very hot weather. He lives in kind of a desert mountain range, not a lot of water. And plus, he was pretty hot looking, too. So he just ended up with the name Jalapeno. I was running a live hunt then, so I kind of had to have a name for him to be able to, because there was multiple big bucks there. You know, I had to be able to say, hey, this is Jalapeno. And so that's where that came from. What was your other question?
So, like, when did do you have a criteria in your head for like your best practices of tracking an animal, or when you decide to quit looking for a deer if you haven't seen him for a while? Like, do you have a set, you know, like algorithm in your head where you decide, okay, I haven't seen this buck in a while, I'm going to quit, or so many days, or how do you decide in your head that you there's a buck that's gone?
Okay. Yeah. I think that was that question that was on that thread on Rock Slide, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, man, I hope you got a long time because I love to talk about this stuff.
All day, Robbie, all day for you.
There you go, girlfriend. I got my coffee here, so kick back. Where's my coffee? Oh, there we go. First of all, it depends on where the deer lives. So, you know, what applies to one deer may not apply to another, all right? So back to the buck that we all killed together last year. That was a early November hunt. The deer are, you know, rutting, they're starting to migrate, they're traveling a lot more. And so that buck could be very hard to locate even the next day. Okay, where Jalapeno, I found him in the early season, I found him in July. And typically those, you know, especially a desert mountain range, and by a desert mountain range, I just mean there's hardly any trees, it's just mostly brush, you know, it's low elevation, that's why it's so hot. And I always hunted him during the archery season. So he was very patternable then. And most bucks are, okay? And so once I figured out where he was living, which just came by glassing and hunting there, you know, I just kept checking that spot. And it would seem like you could find him about every other day, no more than about 3 days. Over multiple years, 2012, 2013, 2014, he never moved out of probably less than a square mile. And so that question that was on Rock Slide is, how did I know when to give up looking for him? Well, it's as much of an art as it is a science. And I don't want to make it sound like, oh, I just know in my heart he wasn't there. I mean, you never know anything for sure. But in 2014, I put trail cameras out in June. I visited the area 3-4 times in the summer. I was always in there glassing before daylight. I've learned that about trail cameras. I don't put all my eggs in that basket. If it's an area I think there's bucks, I'm going to be out there glassing at daylight. And in 3, 4, 5 trips, hundreds of pictures of bucks on trail cameras. You know, there's probably a dozen bucks living in there. He never showed up. And so by late August, just before the season opened, I just made up my mind that, you know, he's not here. And I looked at the surrounding country. I didn't just stay in that square mile. You know, there's several canyons up and down that range, you know, 5 miles. I did the best I could to look for him. I just couldn't find him. And all the other years I could. Well, I'm not one to chase ghosts and spend a bunch of time on hunting a phantom. So I just thought, you know, I need to be looking for other bucks. He was still like a magnet, though, and I did hunt in there opening day. I knew there was going to be archery pressure. I just wanted to make sure, you know, somebody didn't kill him or someone else didn't see him, and he was gone. He never showed back up in the 2015 season. I scouted it again last year. He wasn't there. I really feel like I made a good decision. But in that country that's really open, there's only a few water sources, I was confident moving on. Now, if it was a high country buck, you know, they're not really tied to water. They can move a couple miles, no problem, although they don't usually, especially after the 1st of August. Then, yeah, I might not be so confident giving up on them. But Jalapeno, I mean, I had guys PMing me, friends teasing me, like, there's no way you're for sure that buck's not there. I'm like, you know what, you're right. There's nothing's for sure. But I looking back a couple years, I feel like I made a good decision. He's never shown back up. And by the way, all those youngsters he was running around with, lot of cheaters in that country, so the bucks are pretty identifiable. They're all still there. Hunted one of them last year. He's becoming pretty, might be a 200 inch buck this year, you know. So long answer your question like usual, but that was why I gave up on him.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, it seems like you really gave it, you know, a really good college try, and he's not there. He would still be hanging around the other mule deer that he, or the other bucks that he was with, wouldn't he? I mean, isn't that their pattern? Or
yeah, exactly, Tanya. That was the thing. There was other bucks he was there with that were still there, and he wasn't. I'm glad you bring that up, because there was a couple of very identifiable bucks, and he just wasn't with them. Like big bucks are, he was always kind of a loner. He was usually with two or three bucks, but he would cycle through. You'd see him with different bucks, and, you know, occasionally, seems like there's a week or two, you see those big bachelor herds of, you know, like 10, 15 bucks. He would be in with those. But, yeah, all those other bucks were there, and he wasn't. But, you know, I want to make sure that guys don't just take that, again, as like, okay, well, I've looked a couple times, he's not here, I'm going to move on, because I think that's the mistake we can make. The buck that's in the lead story of my book, I found he was pretty much a high country buck. He lived in the Aspen conifer zone, but, you know, pretty high elevation country. He was there for 2 years, but there was lots of times I couldn't find him, and I ended up finding him in August of 1996. I found him in August, and I killed him the end of October. He'd stayed right in the little 800 yard circle, but there were many days I could not find him. That had to do with a lot of cover, a lot of water, you know, just hard to re-find the same buck. No reason for him to really be in the same place. So you got to use your brain when you're scouting bucks early. You got to think about, you know, what's holding them here. That's a part of why I don't like to scout the high country very early in July. I see a lot of guys starting early. I've kind of been burned on that. I think those bucks are still, unless it's a dry year, pretty much still not settled in. I like to find high country bucks in August. It seems like they're much more findable.
And another question that gets brought up a lot is, in your book, you talked about tracking. How much, you know, obviously we're not going to become Apache trackers, but you talked about the book from Tom Brown, which I've also read. How much emphasis do you put on tracking, and what's your best tracking practices?
I love tracking, man. It is an awesome way to hunt. But like I said in the book, you know, you're not going to kill a lot of your big bucks by tracking. But after you've killed a few big bucks, tracking will have played a part in it. And I think, first of all, we kind of got to define the word tracking. And maybe I didn't do a very good job in it in my book. When we hear the word tracking, we think, okay, there's a track on the ground. I'm going to follow it. There's a buck at the end of it, and I'm going to kill him. That can happen sometimes, but for a big buck hunter, that can be a little, a bit of a gamble, because you know, not all big bucks have big racks, if you know what I mean. You're looking at their track, looking at the size of it, you know, you can tell by their weight, depending on the soil. But you may track him down, and he's a 23-inch heavy buck, which if you're happy with that, that's great. But more often than not, what I mean by tracking is paying attention to what's going on the ground around you, because big bucks don't usually move very far. And if there's big tracks around, I may not be able to track that buck down. You know, I hunt a lot in the Intermountain West where, you know, a lot of vegetation, a lot of water, you know, not sandy soils like the Southwest, where you can really pick up a track and, you know, anybody with a decent amount of skill can stay with it for sometimes a couple of days. It's not the case here unless you're tracking in snow. But I really pay attention to tracks when I'm scouting. If I'm seeing big tracks, I know it's the type of country that can hold mature bucks. Obviously, there's an older buck there, and so that usually attracts older bucks. And then terminally, on the day I kill the buck, it seems like 30-40% of the times tracks had something to do with it. Even if I wasn't tracking the buck, you know, to his bed, it's like, hey, there's fresh tracks on the trail here this morning. They weren't here yesterday. I know this buck is close. That may slow me way down to really, really look at that country. You know, even older tracks that might be a week old, it still tells me that that buck is there, or at least mature bucks are there. I don't want to make it sound like I can always identify a certain buck by a certain track. It just depends on how much recon you have on that buck. If I've seen him in the summer, I go try to check his bed so I can get an idea of what his track looks like, because they'll have identifiable tracks. Not quite like a human fingerprint, but you can tell, you know, the size, how blunt they are on the end. A lot of deer tracks will look like that on the end, but some won't. Right. Some will be a little more classic of a pointed track, depending on how old he is. But you don't always have that much recon on bucks, especially backcountry bucks where you can't spend a lot of time with them. But I'll end it saying this way. I always pay attention to what's going on the ground, always. And if there's fresh tracking snow, I'm out there. Man, short of getting a divorce and losing my job, man, I'm out there if there's fresh tracking snow, because there's a little bit of a window right there that really big bucks are very vulnerable, especially in early October in the high country. Those first couple snowstorms they get, it just kind of, you know, they're not migrating yet. They're still sticking to a pretty small area. So if I spend a day tracking around in those areas, I can figure out if he's still there. I may end up killing him by glassing and classic spot and stalk, but if it's the tracks that are holding me there, I'm just a more efficient hunter. And then, of course, I have tracked down a few bucks, you know, track by track. Boom, there he is, stands up out of his bed. You paste him. That is one of the most exciting moments in hunting, by the way. I hope everybody gets a chance to experience that in their life, because it's awesome.
Gotcha. So what you're saying is a big track might not have a big rack.
Exactly. Big track might not be a big rack. And see that buck right there, that 200-inch buck, that buck was killed primarily because I saw big tracks in the area. And it was in Colorado on the third season, and they're moving a lot then, so it can be hard to keep track of them. But we had pretty stable weather, pretty dry weather, and I kept seeing big tracks in this. It was kind of a plateau with some side canyons on it. Every morning I would find big tracks out on this plateau, and I could tell he'd been cruising does, but I couldn't follow him very far. He'd get in the grass, and I'd lose him. I mean, Tom Brown Jr. could probably track him, but I couldn't. But I just kept going back to that area because I was seeing tracks. And I ended up killing that buck there. Was he the same buck? I don't know. I just, like I said, if a big buck is hanging out somewhere, unless it's just a crap unit with hardly any big bucks, odds are there's going to be other big bucks in there too. And I ended up killing him on the fourth day. I don't know if it was the same buck, but he had big old clomper tracks as well.
Gotcha. That's some good information, because I think people, they don't not discount tracks, but I don't think a lot of times they know exactly what they're looking at either.
One more piece of the puzzle is how I look at it.
All right. All right, moving on to the last podcast we did, we talked about the winter kill.
Yeah.
And you had a post on exactly where to hunt a couple weeks ago on Rockslide.
Oh, yeah. I love tricking people with posts like that.
Well, I never really thought about it. You talked about how with less mature deer, there's going to be less deer in easy to get to spots, or less deer in less. How do you explain that? I guess I'm not explaining
okay,
that well.
Okay. And what I meant by that post, and it was kind of funny, a lot of guys were ribbing me. They said, "Hey man, you said exactly where to hunt in that post." They were thinking, you know, unit, basin, all that stuff. What I meant by that is that when a deer herd shrinks, we've got data from many biologists I've talked to, but you know, several credible resources. You can find it in Richard Mackey's Ecology on Mule Deer. You can find it in Dennis Austin's handbook for mule deer hunters in Utah. They all talk about this phenomenon of when a deer herd shrinks due to winter kill or other things, you know, heavy predation, disease, the deer herd that is remaining tends to occupy the most high quality habitat in the area. And, you know, that might be sort of obvious to people, but maybe not. A lot of people I find think deer just randomly roam the wilderness, you know, like lost children, and I find they don't. And when there's a small deer herd, there's usually some kind of stress on them, you know, like what we talked about, winter, whatever. And they're trying to rebuild the herd. And we see this with, you know, twin fawns, production goes up, even triplets goes up. And the deer that are left need to be in prime condition to perpetuate the herd. You know, that's just how God made it. They're not going to let the herd die out if they can help it. So they'll occupy the most, the best habitats. And that's different everywhere. Around here, the worst, most unproductive habitats tend to be desert. That's why the deer densities are low. The aspen conifer zone tends to be real productive. You know, a combination of enough water. Aspen is just a prime food and is an indicator of other food sources that are palatable to mule deer. So my point in that whole post is wherever you're hunting in the West that had hard winter kill, figure out what your most productive habitat is. There should still be deer in those habitats. And then the opposite is true. As our deer herd starts to peak, those growing part of those deer, they kind of become nomadic. and they'll move out and begin to occupy these less desirable habitats. And I have seen that two or three times in my life just on the foothills east of Idaho Falls, which is not very productive habitat. But as our deer herd starts peaking like it did the last couple of years, there seems to be a lot more deer in those habitats. And I'll even see a few big bucks in there where probably on a year like this, there won't be much there. So it's just how deer are adapting to the winter and, you know, making sure they have the nutrition to get to maximize, you know, birth rates and all that other stuff, in the following seasons.
So when there's years with less, deer numbers, that's the year the guys say, man, there's no deer out there anymore. They're all gone.
You got it, man. And maybe there's definitely less deer even in the desirable habitats, but that's why I bring up the foothills east of my town. There'll be a lot of guys that go out there and hunt this year and go, man, the deer are gone. But I'll talk to some guy that's hunting in the Aspen conifer zone, and he'll say, I saw a lot of deer.
Huh, that's very interesting, because you do hear that a lot. And it's on, not necessarily always on years with bad winter kill, just sometimes the deer aren't there. And for some reason, those people just aren't looking in the right spots, but they'll claim there's no deer.
Exactly. And I talked about this in previous podcasts. Doug Ayers, rest his soul, was a great buck hunter. He used to come up here from California, spend a week or two every year. Great mentor to me. He, in 93, when nobody could find any big bucks, he killed a whopper of a buck, you know, 350 pounds. You know, it only had like 27 inch antlers, but, you know, massive, you know, 6 inch bases, carried it all the way to the top. And looking back over the years, knowing what I know now, he killed that in one of our most productive kind of deer factory units around here. And so when I read this research, I'm like, yeah, I've even got a few case studies where I've seen this to be true when, you know, we couldn't find deer hardly anywhere else. And here he comes home with a whopper.
That makes me ask, like years like this with a bad winter kill, does Robbie Denning change any in the way that he scouts for deer because of that or not?
Yeah, a little bit. And remember, some of it I'm kind of tied to. I know areas that are going to produce deer, and, you know, like some of that low elevation desert country, I'm still going to go scout it. I'm just going to have a sober expectation that I'm probably not going to find a lot of deer, because there's not very many out there. And then when we lose some, we lose even more. However, I'll still scout a lot of the same spots, but they are in the ideal habitat. Yeah. That's why I've always seen big bucks there and everything. But yeah, it does. It probably changes my expectations more than it does my areas. But I put that post out for guys that maybe they're coming to, you know, Western Idaho for their first time. That's where the winter kill was really bad, or, you know, far southeast Idaho. Maybe they're coming their very first time, and I'm just saying that, you know, you probably better focus on the most productive habitat. Talk to your biologist. You know, they're going to tell you what zones are the most productive, and it usually has to do with fawn rearing. But I also find, you know, some fantastic antlers grow at those zones as well.
On that note, why do you think that people should not use Idaho as a fallback state?
Oh, yeah. Well, what I mean by that is I read a lot of guys saying, you know, Idaho should be your fallback state if you don't draw anywhere else. And I can see what they mean. I may have even told people that before, but mule deer hunting is a mental game. All right. So if, let's just say I have a unit 13B Arizona strip tag for November 17th through the 24th, one of the best chances in North America to kill a big deer. I'm going to go down there with a lot of expectations. I'm going to dig deep. I'm going to do my best. You know, I'm going to hunt multiple days. I'm not going to give up. I'm going to throw everything I got at it. Right. Okay. So I don't draw that tag, and I'm back on my fallback tag of Idaho.
Right.
How hard am I really going to try? I mean, after all, this is a fallback tag. I mean, what can I really expect? And so I think it has to do more with your mental attitude of going into it. I get the concept of, yeah, it can be a fallback tag because you can decide on states like Idaho and, you know, Montana. Sometimes they have leftover deer tags, Nevada leftover deer tags. But just don't give it a leftover effort is what I'm talking about.
That makes sense. On the control hunt side for residents, do you think that they can scout them every year, but do you think it's better off to put in for the controlled hunts, and then if they don't draw, obviously they're going to have to hit the general tags? But I think guys that not put in for controlled hunts are kind of stupid if they can scout it.
Yeah, guys are going to be mad at you and me because we're just going to drop the draw odds even more. But yeah, what's the sense in buying an Idaho license, which is non-refundable, $150? It's one reason our draw odds are, you know, about that much better than other states. If you're not going to at least try for a controlled hunt. But remember, too, I mean, everybody wants a formula. I talk about this a lot. And the more amateur you are, the more step-by-step formula that you want. Maybe you know of a really big buck that you saw last year. Somebody saw him in the winter. You saw him in the winter. And you know he's going to be there, a buck like Jalapeno. I don't want a controlled hunt on a year like that. I want to be there with my general tag. That's my best opportunity. As good as controlled hunts are, very few 200-inch bucks get killed on them. So you got to use your brain is what I'm saying. But, yeah, on most years, I'm still applying in the controlled hunts. That's going to up my odds. I want better buck-to-doe ratios, things like that. But, you know, if you got a buddy that lives in a general unit that's saying, hey, man, I'm seeing bucks every year that are, you know, your goal buck, then, and you draw, you know, a unit 22 rut hunt, and you got to go up there your very first time, you might bomb that hunt. You know, you might be better off hunting with your buddy where you got some intel. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. On the same note, we touched on this on the last podcast, but it still gets brought up a lot. The guy making the journey for one deer a year, for one hunt a year in Idaho, is he better off to put into the controlled hunts or hunt over the counter that he can hunt every year and learn it?
I think he needs to play the controlled hunt game to start, and every year, you know, get in for some controlled hunts. We'll talk about a few on this podcast. Most likely he's not going to draw anyways, and he'll fall back on his general. Get 2-3 years of general hunting under your belt, mostly so you know where not to go. A lot of guys think when, you know, every hunt's going to give you some intel on the area. Yeah, it may give you the intel of, I'm not coming back here. This place is terrible. But get 2 or 3 years of that under your belt. And then it's no longer your fallback opportunity. It can be your premium opportunity. You'll figure out 2-3 canyons. It's always got some good bucks in them. And that's what I'm saying. The more intel you have, the less you really need controlled hunts, really good controlled hunts. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. That's, I think, the biggest catch for guys is they come out here one time and have success, and I think when they just think it's like that every year, especially the guy that's new to it.
Dude, it is not. And you know, I think maybe that's something that's changed with mule deer hunting is I have not killed, unless I'm just forgetting one here, mm-hmm. I have never killed big bucks in the same places. It seems like it's always changing. Now, I may go back 5 years later and scout a spot and find a big buck, but it's not repeatable the next year is what I'm getting at. And I don't know if that's just a function of there's not a lot of big bucks in the areas we can all hunt. But I'll say this. You got to be a little bit flexible, and the more areas you know, the better. But then when you find a good opportunity, you stick with it, like Jalapeno, till that opportunity's mm-hmm. gone. You stick with it. But don't get hung up on, hey, I saw a big buck in Unit X last year in that canyon. So I'm going to put my whole 10 days in that canyon this year. You know, I'm talking about a non-resident that maybe couldn't really go back and scout. No, that can screw you right there. He might not be there that year. He might have got killed the day after you left. You just don't know.
Gotcha.
So, Robbie, talk a little bit about the regulations in Idaho, because they're a little diverse. So that people, especially if they're starting new, if they're new hunters, they know what to watch for, how to go about that.
Okay. Our regulations, I think Idaho is probably the most diverse Western state. Just so many opportunities. It's almost confusing. It's almost overwhelming. You know, where, you know, a lot of the states, you know, Colorado's pretty simple. I've memorized how they do their hunt codes. You know, I can look at a unit and figure out what the hunt code is without even looking it up. Idaho's all over the place. Man, they got controlled hunts. They got unlimited hunts. They got general tags. And, you know, then multiple hunts within those. That's why you got to focus and know what you're doing. So let me just sum it up this way for somebody that might be looking at Idaho for the first time. There's a general archery tag in Idaho that runs August 30th to about the end of September, depending on the unit. And there's a few controlled hunts that offer an August 15th opener. Okay. Which one should you try to do? Again, it gets down to your intel and your scouting. What do you know about the area? August is a prime time to start hunting mule deer. I think it gets down to more, how well do you know the area? How efficiently can you hunt it? You know, if I'm coming up from Nevada to hunt Idaho, I'm more efficient to hunt southern Idaho. If I'm coming up to hunt Idaho and I'm from Washington, I'm probably more efficient to hunt western or northern Idaho. You got to think about all that stuff. That has more, to me, that's almost as important as the buck to doe ratio in the unit. You know what I mean?
So you should start
You got general archery hunt. Go ahead.
You should start with the dates that you're able to go and then narrow down a unit that you could hunt. That's what I'm saying.
And get beyond the unit, get down to what I call the small picture research in my book, the exact canyons, basins, ridges, you know, stuff like that. Be efficient. Don't just come and hunt unit 7. I mean, geez, what, that's like, doesn't work anymore. There's not enough deer anymore. Not enough big bucks, I mean by that. So you got to be pretty focused on it, okay? And so yeah, that general archery time is a good time because of what I said earlier. The bucks are pretty patternable then. They're not easy. You're hunting with archery equipment, but they're pretty patternable then. If you find them one day, you can expect them to be there for a while, all right? If you bugger them up, you might have another chance at them. Okay. But once you get past mid-October, either because of the migration or the onset of the rut, deer can move a lot more. Bucks can move a lot more. That gets back to tracking. You'll learn that in tracking. When you start tracking bucks later in the season, they're just a lot harder. They cover a lot more ground. A non-resident who can't scout might focus on the units that offer the October 15th openers for rifle and archery. And those are controlled hunts, and they're, you know, I don't remember. There's 4 or 5 of them scattered out through the state. The reason I say that, it just gives them more time. Time is of the essence. It really is. And I think anybody that's going to try to bite off a non-resident hunt, you better have the resources to do it. And it's wise to be able to come a couple of times. Now, if a hunt is only 10 days long and you can't hunt all 10 days, well, you've lost some efficiency there. But if a hunt is, you know, 30 days long, very few of us can hunt 30 days, including me. My brain just could not handle it. My body could, but not my brain. It's great to be able to come back, you know, take a break, you know, and sometimes that break is, hey, I'm out of vacation. I got to go back to town before I lose my job or my wife moves out on me. You know, get and have a chance to come back and apply some of that knowledge that you had. So these August 15th openers, you know, those deer are going to be probably pretty much there until early October, you know, when the rifle season's open or the migration starts or something like that. And by there, you're not going to see them in the exact canyon under the exact tree, all that. I'm not talking about that. I'm just saying they probably have not left. Okay. So you can be real efficient that way. Okay. And that's what I like about that August 15th opener. It's just more time.
I got two questions because I actually got a question PM me I just thought about. Idaho, the Fishing Game of Idaho are pretty smart, and they run a most of their general season from the 10th of October to the 24th.
Rifle, yeah.
So and I think we've talked about this before. That's probably one of the hardest time to kill big mule deer.
It is.
what do you consider the best times to kill big mule deer?
Well, okay, we just talked about one of them, kind of mid to late August into kind of mid September.
Right.
There's no pressure. Nobody's buggering the deer. Maybe you just have a place nobody's going into for whatever reason. Those deer will be there most likely in most units in Idaho till the middle of October. But, you know, you throw
on
in
that,
the...
I'll go quick on, Robbie. On those August hunts, are almost all those controlled hunts?
No. The August 15th are. I don't think there's any general ones that open August 15th. But there's some controlled hunts that do. That, you know, have a little, because they're archery, they're a little bit better odds. There's even some rifle ones that open August 15th. Some of them are horrible odds. Some of them are pretty good. But yeah, back to the kind of the best time. That's a great time to hunt those deer. You know, you're the first ones hunting them, but it's not just that either. They're just more forgiving at that time. You know, their velvet is on their antlers or they've rubbed fairly recently. They just seem to be more homebodies. You know, jalapeno, I buggered him up a couple times. He still never left that unit. Those canyons I was hunting, but I would notice in later September, he just got a lot harder to find. You know, and I think that's just the natural progression of mule deer moving into the cover, you know, maybe moving into a place that's just harder to do. Something wrong?
No, dog is freaking out.
Oh, okay. I saw the screen jump. I'm kind of going on and on there, but yeah, that early to mid-August, it's going to be mid-August to mid-September. And then the rifle hunt that you just mentioned, October 10th, I can still find bucks on October 10th that were in the same place they were in, you know, early August. Mm-hmm. The problem with October 10th is the armies are out there and they're buggering up your deer.
So this is, obviously you said it, but I just want to reiterate, this is for Idaho. So in Nevada, yeah, there's going to be different dates that are better to hunt. So they just have to find somebody they need to find their Robbie Denning of Nevada. Or Colorado or wherever they're hunting.
Yeah, you just got to use your brain is what it is, because, you know, we're specifically talking about Idaho right now. And I'm saying that most of Idaho, the deer are roughly in the same place in early October that they are in September or August. That's not the case with a big chunk of, say, Colorado. Those deer are moving out of that high country en masse. And some places it doesn't even take any snow. Grays River, that's east of here, those deer will start migrating the 12th to the 20th of October, whether or not they just kind of start moving then. And really by October 25th, a lot of the guys I know are like, yeah, they are gone. They are out of here. And so that's what I mean about using your brain. But, you know, back to best times, because I really want to hit that. The opening day of rifle in Idaho, that's the best time to hunt. Now, it's a pretty small window, a few hours in the morning, but you better be out there. And if you've seen a good buck, you better be staying there, you know, even when you think he's gone, it's worth giving it some effort. And then I think the next time that's a best time to hunt is kind of that November 10th to 30th, depending on weather, depending on the unit. They can still move a lot in that 20 days, but they're headed for winter range. If you find a big buck on a certain day, odds are he's going to be pretty close to that for a couple of days anyways. You know, he's rutting does. He could disappear in a night. But I'm just saying that a lot of times that's a primo time for at least seeing him. At least seeing him. You may lose him the next day because he got on a hot doe and he moved over a canyon. But so mid to late August, opening day of rifle, November 10th to the 30th. Those are your sweet spots for Idaho hunting.
All right. That makes sense. The question that I got PM'd was, we talked a little bit about the guy coming out every year and, you know, what should he do? You know, if he just had rifle or bow. And the guy said that we mentioned controlled hunts. If the guy doesn't matter if it's rifle or bow, and he's coming out every year, is there a weapon that you would choose a general tag for?
Well, I just still have to go archery because a guy that's coming out here the first time, most guys, they need to see deer. They really do. And it's just an easier time to see them. And, you know, for some of the reasons I've said in the podcast, they're just a little more out of the cover. You know, they're a little more findable. But again, I think I said this in the last podcast, that you got to be ready not to get one, especially if you want a big one. So why try it if you're not going to get one? I'm not saying you're not going to get one. There's just odds are you're not. Where, you know, the guys that come out with a rifle, unless they're just really picky, they're probably still going to shoot a deer. You know, and that's a non-resident mindset. I spent $300, so I got to shoot a deer. So it's just like really probably, Ryan, the best way to answer it's personal preference. What do they like to do? You know, both those are opportunities that Idaho offers. This is what I would tell the hardcore. Figure out how to get here for archery and rifle. That's your best chance. And if you can only come once, pick what you like.
Can you repeat that out-of-state accent one more time?
Oh, sorry. God, I hope I didn't offend somebody if you're from that state. I should just do the general Uncle Fred accent.
So, Robbie, Ryan keeps bringing up questions that people have PM'd him to ask you. And I want to know, why don't you ever answer PMs? I PM you all the time. You never answer my PMs. I've heard you don't answer everybody else's PMs. I don't know why Ryan's so special, but please tell people why you may not answer their PMs or emails or voice messages or written notes on your windshield, whatever.
You're talking about when they're inquiring about units
specifically. Yes, I'm sorry, not just in general. I know you answer messages, but on units.
Yeah, like first of all, saying, an apology.
Where do you go? Where do I need to hunt? Tell me a unit specific. I want to know what the tree looks like that the deer are going to stand next to.
Right.
You know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I'm glad you bring that up. And first of all, I apologize to anybody that's ever contacted me about where to hunt and, you know, things like that. And I just don't get back to them. There's a couple of reasons for that. First of all, if you spend a lot of time mule deer hunting and a lot of time learning areas and doing that stuff, and you just start spewing out information to random people about, well, hunt here, and this is my opinion on this unit and this and that. It's the same feeling I get when I'm out and somebody asks to dance with my wife. It's just like, I just don't sit well with me. And you know, that you talk to somebody like Robert Haneman from The Hunting Fool. I mean, he's just totally generous. He'll tell you anything you want. So for me personally, it's just like, I don't, first of all, guys are really respectful. I don't get guys that are, you know, really needling me, being a butthead about it. But it's still like, you know, I wrote a mule deer book to help people. I talk about it in the book. It's more about the how than it is the where. I tell them how I select the where, you know, me personally, the tools that I use. I use the saying of it, you know, teach a man to fish and he can eat for a lifetime. Give him a fish, he only eats for one day. So yeah. If I'm just spewing out units, hey guys, this unit's doing good, go hunt that. Or hey, this is what I know about this unit. I'm not really helping them because I'm going to get asked that 3 times a week. So, you know, even me, on any given year, I might only know 2 or 3 places that are producing good deer. So I'm going to put everybody in the same place, and it's not that helpful for them. It's really not. It's better to learn, you know, their own skill set. What type of country do they do the best in? High country, desert, low country, mid country? Do they need a road camp? Do they need a backpacking camp? Is it a horse camp? Do they like to hunt late season, early season? It's better for them to figure all that out on their own than just, you know, oh, unit 3 is awesome, so I'm going to go there. That doesn't help them a whole lot unless I'm telling them, okay, hunt this canyon, this draw, that kind of stuff, which I'm not going to do.
Is that what you scout for you? Touching a little bit on that where you...
Yeah, you betcha. And I mean, I started a scouting business in 1997 where I actually charged people to scout units. You know, we were one of the first ones around that actually did it. I was the first one on the internet that I know of. Forgive me if you were on there before then. I just didn't know about you. And, you know, I did that for a lot of years, and we were charging $500. It's $895 now to do that work and earning every penny of it. I mean, it takes a lot of time and information and headache and years of experience to kind of know what to look for. And so it kind of gave me a realistic feel for what the value is and what people are really asking for when they tell me, hey, you know, I'm going to hunt unit 70. Can you kind of narrow it down for me on where I should hunt? You don't have to tell me exactly. And they always say the same thing. I'm not looking for your honey holes. I know, but what am I supposed to tell you? The crappy spots? And so it kind of gave me an idea of what it's really involved in giving that good advice. And so I just drew the line there. I just don't do it anymore. I don't even hardly take any packages through my We Scout for You anymore. I've got some guys that work for me. I pass them on to those guys. I don't have time anymore. That's really what it gets down to. And I've got a long client list, and I usually have a friend or someone like you that's like, hey, I'm coming down, can you help me? That's where I'm going to put my time. Okay.
Well, honestly, and so, it's like, I feel like you undercharge for that, because we've been with you and we've been with some of the other guys that work for you, and the amount of time and effort that they put into, you know, scouting those areas is ridiculous. I would charge way more than that because they put so much time and effort into it and really go, you know, the lengths to.
And this is why we've never been able to charge more for it. As soon as I start charging, you know, probably really, you know, $2,000, $3,000, then they're like, well, hey, I could buy a landowner tag, or hey, I could, you know, go on a semi-guided outfitted hunt where, you know, I'm sharing camp with 2 or 3 hunters. And I'm like, you're right, go do it. And then lastly on that question you asked is, and I know guys don't mean it to go this way, but when they start asking me about a unit, and let's just say I do say, hey, yeah, let me help you with it. I'll give you, you know, go try this canyon or whatever. It turns into something bigger than what they even thought. So it's the whole thing. You ask a question and, oh, that made me think of another question. So I might tell a guy, yeah, go down and hunt unit 71, you know, go up there behind the private there. There's, you know, go between the ski resort and those few ranches right there. And I think, okay, good. I helped the guy. Great. Oh my gosh. A week later, he's calling. Well, hey, did you know there's a four-wheeler trail that comes in through the, you know, Fred's place? And I got access to that. Do you think I should come in that way? I mean, it turns into a whole consulting thing. And again, I'm not upset. It's just like, I don't have time for it. I really don't. So when, you know, guys ask me, start asking me about the where, I usually just, I'm just bowing out gracefully is all I'm doing. I wrote a whole book on it. Go get the book. And you know, it'll tell you everything, how I make my decisions. And I didn't hold anything back on what I look for, you know, percentage of 4 points and, you know, buck to doe ratios, how I use Google Earth, you know, boots on the ground, talking to locals. I mean, I give all that stuff in there. And I promise you, if you'll go do that stuff and you do kill a big mule deer, you're going to be so much more satisfied than, hey, I went where Robbie Denning told me and look what I got. So that's why, Tanya, and anybody out there, I'm sorry, I'm just bowing out when people start asking me about units and recommendations. It's too much work. I'm not doing a good job. You know, I'm a Christian. I don't want to lie to anybody. It puts me in a position where I feel like lying to people. And again, it's the same feeling as when someone says, hey man, can I dance with your wife?
I dance with your wife all the time and you don't seem to mind at all. I'm just saying.
Yeah. Yeah. I know you're the only one I'll let because it's, you know, we want to watch.
No, I mean, it seems to me just like if you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. If you do give somebody good information and they happen to go up there that year and there's no deer, then they're pissed off at you because you gave them wrong intel. And then they're like, well, did he lie to me? And, you know, that asshole, I just spent all my time up there and all my days and I didn't see one stinking deer. And I mean, you can't win.
Yep. Yep. And there's another reason I thought of while you were saying that. When I was a young man and I would read in a magazine, some well-known hunter spewing off, you know, go hunt unit 27 East half. There's big bucks there. Oh, it would make me mad if that's where I was a hunter. Is that where that's where I was hunting? It would make me so mad. It's called hot spotting. And I, you know, to me, hot spotting, you know, I'll leave that to the research services, you know, Hunt and Fool, Go Hunt. They're good at it. They can give people good information. But, you know, I just don't like it. I never liked it. I didn't like it when people would promote the areas I wanted to hunt. And at the end of the day, it's just a good feeling to figure that stuff out yourself. It really is. So my apologies to anybody I haven't got back to, but that's why.
I'm with you on the one question leads to 100 questions. And even if you're doing it in their best interests, you're either going to be a hero or an asshole. And if you're a hero, they're going to ask you again.
And tell all their friends to ask you.
Exactly. Well, yep. I think we covered a lot. I just want to tell everybody that I went down and shot in sagebrush, so that's why my face is puffing. I look like Yoda again.
I didn't hit him.
So
hard.
Yeah, you can see it looks. Sagebrush and me don't get along.
Dude, you're still pretty beautiful, though, for a man. Just saying.
That's so sweet of you to say, Robbie.
I appreciate that. Tanya was down at the Red Rock Shooting School, and she was shooting out the 1,000 like a champ.
It was awesome.
Great. When are you guys coming back for the Vortex Challenge? What is that, August or so?
August 4th.
August 4th.
Let's try to get together and do a podcast then. Maybe we can do one live. We don't have to mess with all this internet stuff that's such a pain.
Yeah, maybe we'll come down there a day or two early and
get Jody on there.
Get Jody on there, Robbie. We can tell all your dirty secrets.
Oh, man. She's got a lot on me. Don't ask too many. But I've got some on her, too, so she better be careful.
But hey, I want to touch on your We Scout for You service because I don't think you highlighted enough. I know one of your scouting guys pretty good, and
Jim Carr.
I'll tell all the people out there, you're getting when he does a scouting package for you, you're getting 10 times what you're paying for it.
That guy's a gazelle.
He is a gazelle, and he knows what he's looking for. He may be crazy as hell with OCD, but he is a good scouter.
He is, dude. He's been working for me since 2008. He's probably almost full right now. I don't know when you're going to air this podcast, but you know, if you need scouting in northern, western, and central Idaho, he's the man. He might be full by then, but he's a good guy. He's got a good heart for it. You can't go wrong with him. I've never had a legitimate customer complaint from any of the packages he's done, and I'll bet he's pushing 75 to 100 packages that he's done for me. He knows more country in Idaho than anybody I've ever met, especially for a person that has never aerial scouted. I mean, he's just a hound dog. He gets out there. He loves to learn about the units, and you know. So, selfless plug there, but yeah, he's good.
No, and that's so. Where do they find that?
You can just go to wescoutforyou.com. You'll see you can email on there. I get the emails and then I divvy them out to the guys. Jim's my only scout this year. You know, we kind of ebb and flow there. I've had as many as three guys working for me. Just depends on, you know, supply and demand and where we're going. And I'll put this out too. I've really wanted to expand into Colorado. I get tons of questions about Colorado. If there's anybody down there that's reliable, doesn't have anything more than a misdemeanor on hunting and fishing. And, you know, because think about it, I parked too close to a Forest Service sign and I got one. And, you know, knows either a lot of country or knows some enough country that they can reliably help people. You know, we may be looking for someone else down there. Some years I do Nevada, depending on if I'm hunting down there. And again, this is not, you know, spot your buck. There he is. Go hunt under that tree. He's going to be right there. But it really gives you a leg up on, you know, just the logistics of it. Where to camp, where to hunt, where we've seen game or where we think game is going to be based on our years of experience.
So that's, you do the whole state of Idaho and a little Nevada.
Yeah. And some years I do Western Wyoming if I'm going to be over there. I'll give a plug for Brian LaTurner on monstermuleys.com. He's probably the best for Western Wyoming. He's over there a lot. I've sent him some guys. They've all been pretty happy. And for you haters that are out there, all right, don't send me an email. I don't want to hear that you don't agree with this. It's legal in every single state. I've checked with them. We don't meet the people in the field. We're just sending them maps. We're just giving them a leg up. And hunting is dying. There's not enough people. So if we're helping some guy from Missouri come out here and go deer hunting, it's probably going to ensure your kids can go hunting someday. All right?
I totally agree. For That's the haters, right. you can go to www.eatshit.com.
Yeah,
there you go. That's our email address where you can send complaints to. Thanks for bringing that up, Brian.
Send it to me. I'll create a really crafty response, and it'll probably be something like "F you, die." I don't know.
It's funny. The guys that I hear from on that are almost always residents of the state that they're in, and they're always worried it's going to impact their unit. Well, we only, you know, do one party per unit. You know, a lot of years we're not even in units. I mean, it's negligible what it does. And yeah, if everybody starts doing it, it's going to have a negative effect. Well, I'll tell you what, when everybody starts wanting to lose money on a business proposition and they're doing enough of it to impact our hunting in the West, then I'll consider closing the shop.
And you don't have a hot spot in Idaho. Jim's been there, I swear. Been there.
I've hunted with Jim, and I'm telling you, if Jim is your scout, you better be ready to hunt because he has worked his ass off. I can't keep up with Jim. Jim, oh my gosh, he's amazing. I don't know how he manages to cover the ground that he does, but he'll be up a mountain and back before I can even get like 20 yards. It's insane. He's insane. He will do exactly what he says. And if he says something, you better believe it because he knows.
Yeah. And the when I said I've never had a legitimate complaint on him, when the complaints I've have had is he's put people where it's too hard to hunt.
Yes.
That's not a legitimate complaint. Exactly. Sorry.
That's what I'm trying to say without sounding like if you're a big fat ass that wants to shoot out of your truck, don't go with Jim because that's not going to happen.
Right. That's right.
And you're he'll probably need a tell you, get out of your truck, fat ass, and let's go. I mean, maybe not, but he should.
Hey, you got one more question. I can't let it slide. You got a misdemeanor for parking too close to a Forest Service sign?
Yeah, dude, I did. The only hunting violation I've ever had was, you know how the forest is, you know, every year they're kind of changing trails and access and stuff depending on their plan. One of the places that I hunt around here had a two-track road that left the main gravel road, and it went about a mile, and then it turned into a trailhead. And, you know, it was a pretty rough two-track road, but you could drive a four-wheel drive down it pretty easy. So for years, probably like five different times over 10 years, I would drive down that road and I would park my horse trailer at the end of it. And in my mind, that was the trailhead. Well, I went there, it was in the summer scouting, and it pulled up and the road, there was no gate on it or anything, but there was a sign right next to it that said, no motorized access beyond trailhead. And I thought, well, that's pretty obvious. You can't even drive up the trail. I mean, you know, maybe a motorbike or something. But so I thought, okay. So I drove down that road, parked at the trailhead, went back in the country for a couple days, come back, and there was a ticket on my window because I drove on the trail. And I'm thinking, no, I didn't. I took, you know, this was before cell phones. I took a bunch of pictures to prove, you know, I didn't drive on that trail. You couldn't physically drive a Ford pickup up that trail. I don't even think you get a quad up it. So when I got back, I called the forest ranger and told him, and you know, and he was like, no, I have pictures of your truck driving on the trail. I was like, I don't even know what you're talking about. And come to find out, they had designated that two-track the trail.
Gotcha.
So it became the trail when you left the road, and what I considered was the trailhead. That wasn't anything anymore. And I told him, well, I'll tell you what, man, I respect your authority. I understand you're out here doing this stuff for us all. I'll pay the ticket. It was $80 or something. I could have gone to Pocatello and fought it. But I told him, that is not fair, and most people are going to misinterpret that. You really need to get a gate on that. No, and then he gave me this big thing about their budget for gates. But I went back about 3 weeks later, and he had put a steel post right in the middle of the road and put the sign on the steel post. So, you know, I think he realized that I had a case there. Don't know how we got onto that. Oh, yeah, we were talking about We Scout For You. If you have those kind of hunting violations, you're probably normal. If you get out and hunt, you're probably breaking a law. But What I was talking about is, you know, I don't hire guys that have poaching convictions, you know, and Things like that. And, you know, but there's legitimate mistakes people can make in the field.
I thought you were just Baja-ing with the Toyota up some trailheads.
Oh, man, you couldn't have got the Toyota down that one right there. I'd have had it high centered.
I asked the guy because they moved the trail. A road that was, they turned into a trail. And I asked the Forest Service guy, he goes, yeah, we do that to sell maps. So you got to stay current with your maps to know which roads are open and closed, which is probably true.
Oh my goodness.
At least he's honest.
Yeah. Well, anyways.
Hey, so our next podcast, I guess is probably going to be June, July, right in there. I know you and I are going to be seriously testing out some trail cameras. We won't say a whole lot about it right now because we're trying to make a deal on it. So that'll be a watch for that on Rock Slide. We just started a 7-day cold bow, one-shot challenge today on our archery forum.
I saw that.
I encourage you to jump on there. We're giving away a $100 Black Ovis gift certificate. But what it is it's a way to test your maximum effective yardage in a public way. So there's no bull crap. And it's going to be a lot of fun. I'm getting a lot of response from it. Tony Treach, one of our writers, he's also going to do it. Basically, if you've got a 7-day period where you're willing to only shoot your bow one arrow a day and take a picture of it, you can post on that thread, pick your maximum effective yardage, and then we're going to put the money where our mouth is. We'll see if that's really our effective yardage. I started today. Everybody's got my commitment. I'm just going to shoot one arrow a day, no funky stuff. If I miss the vitals, that's the picture for the day. I think it'll be a lot of fun. And like I said, Black Ovis is going to give $100. Not to the best shot. That's just going to be random for people participating. We're going to wrap it up June 30th. It'll be a lot of fun.
Yeah, it looked like it'll be a lot of fun. That definitely will tell you when you should and shouldn't shoot.
You bet. Traditional archers, if your maximum effective yardage is 30 yards, post it up. If you're a long range guy, you're thinking 80, 90, fine, post it up. Whatever. In fact, if anybody gets on that thread and starts judging and all that stuff, I'll let Ryan, the band hammer Avery, take care of them. Because it really is, you guys, just about whatever you personally think is your maximum effective yardage. And you know, that can be debated for hours. We're not going to get into that. Let's just show everybody what it really is and what we're capable of. I put mine at 70 because that's what I wrote in the book. That's what I've always felt like I could do. Today's the first day of the challenge. So far, one arrow
looked good.
The kill zone.
Yeah.
We'll see if I can do that 7 days in a row.
I didn't realize that was 70 yards. That's a good shot.
Well, today it was, dude. But keep in mind, I've been fiddling around this for years. There'll be some days, dude. I'll be way out of the kill zone. And that's the other thing too. I'm not trying to shoot in perfect weather, not looking for good conditions. Just walk out, shoot it, take a picture, post it. It is what it is. And then after that, we can decide really what our maximum effective yardage is.
All right. I have two things I want to highlight. If we're talking about sponsors is me and Tanya went to that shooting school. She shot and their SIG rangefinder is legit. That 6-2400 rangefinder is, if you want to get a quick range to dial at almost any yardage, that thing is, you still got to call your own wind calls, but for getting the elevation, it's right now.
Yeah, it was money. It was right on.
And, you know, and we've been hearing that on Rock Slide for a year now. I mean, even when they just had the 2000, Justin ran that thread on it. He had great luck with it. I think we have a live thread going on it right now, don't we?
Yeah. Justin's coming out. He puts up a forum, like overall impressions, and he's going to do a review on it. But anybody on the fence, I can tell you right now, I pretty much used every rangefinder out there. That 2400, if you're a not even necessarily a long range shooter, it worked for a bow hunter, it'll work for intermediate ranges, and it worked for the long ranges.
You got it. And for those of you that maybe are not familiar with what we do on Rock Slide, I mean, that's what it's all about. It's all gear, and, you know, it's kind of a judgment-free zone. You know, we want to hear from everybody. We learn from everybody. And if you're not sure about that rangefinder, just because we said it, hey, no problem. Get on that live thread. It's not just for Justin, who's one of our staff writers. It's for anybody to post their experiences on there. And, you know, if you're having a bad experience, we let you, as long as it's legit and you're fair, we let you put it up. And so that allows people to come on to Rock Slide and, you know, not just listening to us, you know, blowing our horns for our sponsors, but actually to see what people, regular members, regular hunters, are really experiencing with this gear. And we've got those spread out through all different forums on Rock Slide. Just watch for them.
Yeah, and we don't love everything. If you go look at your binocular video you just put up, you said what you liked about the Sig binoculars and what you didn't like about the Sig binoculars. So
exactly. For their price point, they're a good binocular, but they're not a Swarovski. I'm not going to get on there and say that. And Sig is a sponsor. But that's one reason they are a sponsor, because they allow us to say what needs to be said about the gear. But I will say that's a great binocular for a $500 price point. But I've opened that thread up to other people, too. As those binoculars hit the market, I'd like people to get on there and post their experiences. Again, it has to be fair. It can't be just, I looked at them before work this morning and they suck, and then they don't get back on. You know, I'll ban that one. We need to hear.
Or putting up links in their threads to try to sell stuff, or, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I've seen that. But, no, as far as the Sig rangefinder, I just wanted to say really quick, I'm very new at this, and that's the first rangefinder that Ryan's had that I've been able to pick up and be able to use and understand, because it's so easy to use. The other rangefinder he's had on other hunts, and I'm not going to say what it is because, for one, I don't know, but I couldn't figure out how to use it. He's screaming at me like, I don't know what the rangefinder from Sig, you push the button, and it's all the information displays right there. And the other one, I mean, it's so easy and light to carry. I loved it. I was using it the whole time. Actually, we were fighting over it because he was wanting to use it, and I was like trying to use it. But that school, it was amazing. I wanted to say real quick, we're going to do a whole thing on it. But the guys at Red Rock that put it on were very, very nice, really helpful. They had great instructors that I felt worked really well with me being a girl. And I was a little anxious because I knew I was going to be the only girl there. And all my classmates were really awesome with helping each other. And it was really, really good, knowledgeable school. I didn't feel like they had anything that was too much, like above my skill level. But if somebody was at a higher skill level, the instructor certainly could adapt their teaching to answer their questions. But I felt like it really, really was the perfect amount for me and for everybody, because they just immediately could figure out how, and there were several of them. So if you couldn't really grasp what one of them was saying, because they, you know, it wasn't the way you learn, they had other instructors that everybody was jumping in to help everybody. And it was amazing. It was so helpful. I'll do it again just for a refresher if I can. And other guys were saying that too, that we're going to come back to go right before they had their hunts, just for a refresher and kind of sharpen up their skills again. The lodge they set us up in was beautiful. They had cooks there that were bringing us lunch out to where we were shooting. Sweet.
It's a level one.
Red Rock is this? Sorry, I wasn't up on this.
Red Rock Precision.
Red Rock Precision.
Okay, Precision Rifle guys in Utah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They have a level one. This was a level one course, and they have a level two course.
Excellent. Excellent. Yeah, I didn't know that. You know, even though we're business partners, Ryan and I, we can't keep track of each other. I didn't know you were even down here.
They have a, we sold a few of your books down there, Robbie, by the way.
What's that?
We sold a few of your books too down there.
Hey, dude, thank you, man. That's what makes my house payment, dude. If the book sales stop going, dude, I'll be living back in that little camp trailer that you saw last year. So, yeah, keep them coming.
It's going to be hard to get all those deer heads in there.
Yeah, that'll be a challenge.
I'll put them in the shed next to it.
It was a great school. I felt really I felt really welcomed. All the guys that were there were great. It's a little intimidating, I'm going to be honest, being a female in this industry and being a beginner. So I didn't feel at all like I was, I didn't feel at all apprehensive, or they were really great and took the time to teach. I was having a lot of trouble on the first day, which I found out later wasn't actually my fault, but they took a lot of time just trying to help me get on to the target and be able to shoot it. And they wouldn't just walk away if I wasn't getting the concept. They would stay there until I got it. So that was awesome.
All right. Good deal, man.
All righty. Well,
hey, you too. Thank you.
No, thank you.
Month and a half. What are we going to talk about next time?
Well, dude, hopefully we have that trail camera deal going by then, and I can talk a little bit about how I use trail cameras. If anybody read the book, I love trail cameras, but I don't put all my eggs in that basket. But I think there's some legitimate places where they can improve your odds. So we'll probably be talking about that. I think the winter kill issue is kind of over. Just make sure you make a phone call before you go hunting and find out how your unit was affected. And by then, we should also be probably starting to talk about some serious scouting.
Absolutely.
Beyond trail cameras.
We should have all of our draws back by then, so everybody knows what they're going to be doing.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. When does this podcast air?
I'll probably put it up next week.
All right, yeah. So we'll still have Colorado, Nevada, Utah out there. Anytime after that, it's going to get wild.
All right, Robbie, we appreciate you coming on again.
Thanks, Robbie. Thanks. Tell Jody hello.
I will.
All right, bye.
All right. If you want to be in the drawing for the Kefaru 14er, leave us a review on iTunes or Stitcher, or leave a comment on Podbean. Pretty much all these podcasts are now on YouTube, so if you'd rather watch us than listen to us, go over there and check that out. We have everything pretty much up on AveryAdventures.com. And if you want to contact us about Avery Adventures podcast for any reason, please go through the AveryAdventures.com website. Thanks for listening. And I'm hoping to get out another podcast in the next 2 days to kind of catch up, and then another one next week. So we really appreciate you guys listening. We know there's tons of podcasts out there, but we all know they're not as good as ours. Anyways, thanks for listening.